I was coming from Montgomery. I had my guitar on my back. When a stranger stopped beside me in an antique Cadillac. He was dressed like 1950, half drunk and hollow-eyed. Say, it's a long walk to Nashville, would you like to ride? I sat down in the front seat, turned on the radio. Them sad old songs coming out of them speakers was solid country gold. Then I noticed the stranger was ghost white pale when I asked him for a light. I knew there was something strange about this ride. He said, "Drifter, can you make folks cry when you're playing sign? Have you paid your dues? Can you moan the blues? Can you bend them guitar strings? Boy, can you make folks feel what you feel inside? If you're big star bound, let me warn you, it's a long, hard ride."
Hello and welcome to Doc Young's Wrestling Weekly. My name is Victor Sosa. Alongside the legend Les Thatcher, as always, a very special week here at Doc Young's Wrestling Weekly, as this week's show is brought to you free. One of the many shows available here at F4WOnline.com. In fact, one of about 15 or so different podcasts, including several with the great Dave Meltzer, the man who put together the Wrestling Observer, which is also available on this site for a mere bag of shells, as they say, Les, just $9.99 a month. Unless you're a big timer like Les Thatcher, then you get comped.
Okay. And I want to tell you, for historical purposes, this is not the first time I've worked for free. Okay. There's been times I've wrestled. I thought, Jesus, are they going to ask me to pay them? No, never mind. Anyway, here we are. Yeah, before we get into wrestling, I want to say for anybody that's listening that may have popped a like or offered their thoughts and prayers for my wife's surgery this week, thank you so much, and God bless you all. She came, for those who don't know, she had her fourth knee surgery on the same knee in less than 10 months on Tuesday, and came through it like a champ. The doctor said the infection, bone infection, as best he could tell, was gone. In the last 2 days, she has actually walked on that leg for the first time in almost 3 months, so we're, some of the pressure is off us anyway, and I just want to say, you know, for anybody that offered their thoughts and prayers, thank you so much, and we appreciate it.
Well, according to the way Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez talked earlier this week on Wrestling Observer Radio, you should be offering some thoughts and prayers for Roman Reigns, not that he's injured or anything like that. But the fact, oh, by the way, I didn't mean to just scoot past this. You know, you and I get a chance to talk for a few minutes off the air. I am very glad to hear that Mrs. Thatcher is doing well, feeling well, and that everything so far so good has gone well, not only for her sake, but for yours as well.
Thank you. Yes, because the collateral damage is my psyche and nervous system. But anyway, thank you so much, Vic. Yeah, you know, the Reigns thing, I didn't see all of Raw this week simply because that was on Monday and my old butt was in bed at 10 p.m. because I had to get up at 4 to be at the hospital at 5:45 a.m. to start the pre-op procedure for my wife. So anyway, what I did see, and I didn't think I really missed a lot, was two handicap matches back-to-back. Let's start the week with handicap matches. We haven't had any in a while. Well, it's actually been a week since we haven't had any. And the week before, never mind. I'm not going to get into that. You know, the Reigns thing, he is green. And as you've heard me say here, I see a lot of upside. His look, I said to you before we started recording, I mentioned to you a couple weeks ago when he first did his, standalone promo, I guess you want to call it. And I said, I would have him dummy down, back off a little bit on the cockiness, on the ego, you know, like, well, yeah, if I'm here, John Cena is finished, you know, or whatever, you know what I'm talking about. And I said, then maybe you need to back off on that a little bit. And I know Dave and Brian were discussing, the lukewarm reception that he got, on Monday night. And maybe that, you know, to me, it's not always everything that's out front and in black and white. Sometimes it's this subconscious stuff. We deal with that with fans, you know? And what I mean by that, I know, you know, I'll get into years ago more than currently. When Dusty cut a promo, Wahoo McDaniels cut a promo, Blackjack Mulligan cut a promo, Flair, guys like that, you knew, I mean, it was them. It wasn't somebody writing a script. It wasn't somebody telling him what to say. It was coming from that Roddy Piper, another one. You know, these guys, came across as legit. So if Wahoo told you to kick somebody's ass, you bought that, right? I just felt that, you know, I've said to you, Roman Reigns is my, Dirty Harry. The Clint Eastwood character from a number of years ago. But he was, talk about walking softly and carrying a big stick, that was Dirty Harry. Raylan Gibbons, if you watch Justified on the FX channel, here is my, what I've said is my current Dirty Harry. And if I were building a babyface and had a guy that could play that particular part, I would have me a Raylan Gibbons. He is very laid back, soft spoken, but as lethal as a rattlesnake. And to me, that's what my Roman Reigns would be. Because he doesn't need to get loud. He doesn't need to get cocky. Because he has that great look. So maybe that's part of it. As far as his selling, well, you know, all of us, I say all of us from several generations back, we learned a lot of our craft, you know, on the job training. And so how many guys on that roster, and this is not a personal knock, this is an evaluation of technical skills and talent. It's not because there aren't enough people out there, holding my hand up here, who can teach details and sound fundamentals and foundation. It's just that a lot of the young guys on our roster aren't capable because they haven't been taught it. And that's not to say behind that curtain, there's Fit Finley, Dean Malenko, Jamie Noble, Arn Anderson, who can all teach exactly what I'm talking about. But the writers and whoever else is, in charge, whether it be directors behind the scene or owners or whoever, are looking for, a carnival atmosphere, song and dance, bad cop, whatever. So they're not stressing that sort of thing. But the point is, how many guys on that roster can go out there on a house show, have a 15-20-minute match with Roman, and actually help educate him as we move along? There aren't that many. So that's part of the problem. I talked to somebody yesterday who said, man, so many people are into the NXT show, like the Lance Storm, right? And a lot of them are guys who have wrestling backgrounds saying, this is a professional wrestling show where they actually, this guy yesterday said, we see somebody work a headlock for 2 or 3 minutes. Like, that's a revelation, right? So
it is today.
Yeah, it is today, right. If you haven't done 6 dives through the friggin' ropes and 14 moonsaults, then you probably, don't have any talent. Actually, it takes very little talent to do those things I just mentioned, less so than actually understanding the psychology and ebb and flow of a professional wrestling match. So, I think that's part of the problem, Vic, is, the people with the knowledge to teach him properly are there. It's just that they're not lacing up boots for the most part. Jericho and Orton, I know that's his next opponent. There are things he, and Randy, a lot of people, Randy's boring. He's a solid worker. And you offset that solid worker with somebody on the other side of that match who's a little more flamboyant, which doesn't necessarily have to be Roman Reigns in this case, but I'm just saying, that's how you pair people up. We've talked about Cesaro and Van Damme not having any chemistry, yet they kept throwing these two guys back together. So, I think that's, the people behind the scenes get disenchanted with Roman because, well, they can, God knows, I hope they don't, but they should also look in the mirror for part of the problem.
I'll give you that. Hey, for those who are listening to us for the first time, freeloaders, as Brian likes to call you, with love, of course, that would probably mean you're not yet a subscriber, so you didn't hear Dave and Brian talk about this on Wrestling Observer Radio the other day. And so let me just back up a little bit, Les, on that issue before I ask you a question about selling.
Sure.
Basically, Dave and Brian were talking about the rather tepid reactions, as Les mentioned, not just on Monday night for the handicap match Reigns had with Orton and Kane, but for the four-way at the show this past Sunday, Battleground, where they teased and teased the face-off between Reigns and Cena. And when they finally got it, or got to it, the crowd wasn't all that into it. And so Dave's point the other night to Brian was that he really felt a big part of why Reigns gets good reactions when he's on screen or cutting a promo, but less so in the ring, is that he is not very good at selling. And at this point, folks are just kind of so conditioned to him grabbing the hot tag that that's what they want. That's almost what they expect or want from him. So the whole full match thing for them with Reigns hasn't taken yet, and nor has Reigns become really effective as a seller. And Dave really stressed that point about Reigns' selling needing to improve. And both of them kind of wondered aloud whether or not the company, or the crowd, frankly, will turn on Reigns before Reigns turns the proverbial corner in the ring. And so with all that said, Les, I want to ask you, as a trainer, as someone who's been in the ring both as a wrestler and for the last 20-plus years as a trainer, how difficult as a trainer is it to teach the art of selling, because it's an art in and of itself? And conversely, as a worker, back in the day when you first got in the ring in the first time in the early 60s, how difficult was it for you to pick up on how important it was?
Honestly, and listen, I'm not about blowing my own horn here. I didn't feel that it was all that difficult. Part of it was, maybe I was frightened not to do what was right. It was like, If you were working with a grizzled veteran, let's say, and you weren't selling enough, it's sell this kid, sell it, goddammit. That's where, and with some of these guys, they put enough fear in your heart that, okay, I'm there. There's, as you and I have talked about with Paige, one of my problems, minute technical problems with Paige was she didn't sell, she died. And there's a fine line between dying and selling, and there's also a fine line between selling and being Superman. I think what the writers there need to get a grasp of is the fact that you have one Superman. His name is Cena, who's very, who makes his comeback 0 to 100% in virtually a half a second, who, after having his butt handed to him by half the world on Sunday night, shows up Monday smiling with no bruises and saying, hey, wasn't that cool? You only need one to a roster. I think across the board, probably part of the is so there's so much duplication in styles and talents that, things kind of get lost and diluted in terms of their value. But with Reigns, it's a matter of working with guys who that was the thing when I broke into business, and for those who don't know, that was 54 years ago. You just opened your ears and listened, you had somebody out there to lead you. There's so many young guys, and not necessarily, I shouldn't say necessarily young, because some of them aren't that young, but inexperienced or weren't taught, good sound fundamentals in that respect. So where does he learn this? He works with Orton. He can pick it up. He can work with Jericho. He should be able to work with Cesaro and pick it up. I don't want him working with Ambrose, but I know for a fact firsthand that Dean is capable of that. It comes down to time. And it's not something you sit down and say, okay, here's what you need to do, go out there and do it. It comes with time. And I don't think maybe it has changed in terms of it takes longer today for the young guys on the independents, because some of them only work once a month or once a week. Back in the day, the first week in the business, I worked three times, and that escalated into five times a week, six times a week, and so on. And you work with people very much more experienced than yourself. He doesn't have that available to him, and it's going to take longer. But the saying was that in our business, you were a rookie the first 3 to 5 years. And that's when we were working, 3 to 5 to 6 times a week. So these guys just don't have that. And at the developmental level, they're basically working with one another, you know. So, which I won't go into that whole spiel, but I've said all along that they need to hang on to guys who are capable of, you know, there are guys out there who can still work, are capable without going in the ring and teaching. But, you know, the thing about being the vulnerability of a baby face, somebody doesn't allow it. And so that's why they've lost so many of the people, too. There's a show on A&E called Longmire. It's from a series of books. It's about a sheriff in Wyoming. I watch it. I really got into it. As I mentioned, Justified and Raylan Gibbons on the FX channel. The comparison with both these, I mean, they're entirely different in the aspect of the show, but with both the key characters, they have vulnerability. They can be had. Walt Longmire, the sheriff in the series Longmire, Lance Storm, I saw him post on Facebook here a few weeks back. He finally got into it and has been catching up on and loves the show. But part of the reason that baby face, that you can get behind him and sympathize with him and you know, cheer for him to do the right thing or to win the battle against the bad guys, is because he has that vulnerability. And that's Rain, as cool as he looks, as badass as he is, he needs that vulnerability as well.
As a trainer, whether you were running Heartland Wrestling Association, developmental territory for WWE years ago, or even today when you're doing these weekend-long training camps/seminars, are there any particular bullet points you make sure you want to get into these kids' heads when you talk to them about selling?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things. When we talk about, when we use the term sell up, it doesn't mean like stand up and sell. It means people have to see your face. If your face is buried in the mat, if your face is buried in somebody's back or chest or something, then I don't know if you're laughing or crying, you know. And your body language. See, and that's the thing. When you're laying out a match in the dressing room and you have to memorize step by step by step, that in itself is a chore. I cannot do that. Never was taught to do it. And the people that started with me from get-go were taught to call a match in the ring. But part of what I'm getting at here is if I'm trying to remember spot, you know, move number 42 that comes after move number 41, my mind is already one place. So, more importantly than that is Vic Sosa just punched me. Was this the first punch? Was this the 21st punch? Are we a minute into the match? Are we 10 minutes into the match? Meaning, how do I sell that to make it to bring the people then emotionally into the ring with me and get behind me? Big fiery comebacks. Everyone talks about Shawn Michaels' great comebacks. Why were they so great? Because he knew how to sell. You have to come back from somewhere. If you've never been away, basically, you can't come back. And so there's such an art form to this that is lacking in a lot of the talents today because it's more important than how many backflips they can do or dives or this and that. So the you know, as my dear friend Jim Cornette always says, it's all in the details. And it is. It's the finer points that tie all the big goofiness together. And so that's, you know, that's the thing you look at. The only time that I recall in my relationship with Jim Crockett Sr., was that, and I can even tell you the town, it was the first time I was ever in that territory in 1963. We were at a spot show in Gastonia, North Carolina, which is just south of Charlotte. Mr. Crockett didn't come to a lot of these things, but since this was close to home, he came there. And I believe it was a gentleman by the name of Jan Madrid who I was working with. I was just a young guy, 3 years in the business, and I was putting Jan over. I don't remember what the finish was, but I didn't sell it enough before I came back to the dressing room. And Mr. Crockett cut a promo on me right there. And I can guarantee you that I worked with Mr. Crockett off and on up until his death, and he never had to cut a promo on me ever again because I got the message. But I hadn't sold Jan's finish as much as he thought I should. And like I say, this business, the art, the true art form of professional wrestling is not about hours and days and weeks, and it's about a few seconds, a minute. You know, it's minute things that tie great actors. You know, I've heard, you know, wrestlers called, they're all actors. And then I watch some of the movies and some of the skits on Monday night and Thursday night and realize, no, we're not. None of us should even claim to be actors. But anyway, except maybe The Rock and a couple guys like that. But anyway, the great actors, Al Pacino, you know, Kirk Douglas, Michael Douglas, whoever it happens to be, your Academy Award winners, George Clooney, it's not about the big, huge things that they do. It's not necessarily about their costuming. It's not necessarily about the big fight scene or the, the big dramatic love scene, whatever. It's what builds to that and what takes you away from that is actually more important, because that's what showcases and makes that particular thing so important. And it's the same thing with the professional wrestling business, but it's kind of being lost. And I don't mean to get into a rant here, but you ask about the details, and that's the details. It's like if you have an arm bar on me, let's say, on my left arm, and I'm waving my right arm in the air, that's what my friend Dean Malenko calls the 747 cell. If you legitimately, now I'm trying to make a point here about minute details. If I legitimately are applying pressure, I mean, or you are legitimately applying a lot of pressure to that left arm, that right hand is going to be at my left shoulder or trying to reach you to relieve that pressure, not waving like an idiot out here to my right side. Does that mental picture make sense to you?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I saw it as soon as you talked about the 747. I've seen it a million times.
Yes, haven't you? And I call people on all the time. A quick historical story about that. My dear friend Ricky Steamboat started in the business with Vern Gagne in Minnesota. When the first time he went to Tampa, Florida, he was still young and still inexperienced. This is where he got the name Ricky Steamboat, because he resembled Sam Steamboat, who had been a big star in Tampa in the Florida territory for a lot of years. So Ricky tells his story, so I know it's legitimate. Eddie Graham, who was the promoter, said to Ricky, I want to make you a baby face because he was a handsome kid. Okay, can you sell? Oh, yeah. So Eddie puts his hands around Ricky's neck as though he is choking him in a working manner. In other words, he's applying no pressure. And he said, sell this, and he grabbed Ricky around neck as though he were choking him in a work manner. And Ricky starts waving his arms out at the side, the 747 cell. Without saying a word, Eddie takes his thumbs and drives him into Ricky's Adam's apple. Now Ricky goes to Eddie's wrist trying to relieve the pressure. Eddie said, that's selling. And one of the things that I stress through all these camps that I do, or through the kids that came through my school in Cincinnati when I had that, was that if you want the people to believe it's real, you have to compare this with a real fight or a real wrestling match or a real battle of some sort. And if you're more concerned with all the histrionics and the theatrics opposed to the real, the small details in terms of the realism, then they're not going to buy it either. You know?
It reminds me of seeing Ricky Steamboat say in a couple of different places how he would watch boxers to see how they reacted from solid shots they took over the course of a fight.
Sure.
To figure out how he was going to sell a punch.
Well, you know, I tell kids now, watch, if you watch UFC, what's his name, Weidman, that beat Anderson Silva?
Chris Weidman.
Weidman, yeah. I said, you know, once Weidman knocked Silva down, he didn't turn around and ask the crowd if he should hit him again.
No, he sure didn't.
And if he did, then, everybody in UFC would have dumbed him dumbass of the year, right? I mean, it's, there's a time and a place for the theatrics, and in the middle of the battle is hardly the place or the time. Again, if you want to draw me in emotionally and make me believe, you know, and to me, our business should be still about suspending your disbelief opposed to increasing it.
Well, between a few stories about young Ricky Steamboat and getting a promo cut on you by Jim Crockett Sr. Now is probably a good time to get to the main event topic, as it were. Figure since you're heading to Charlotte, North Carolina for the final Mid-Atlantic Wrestling Legends Fan Fest next weekend, I thought it would be kind of fun to spend the rest of the show talking about your different runs in the Mid-Atlantic territory and the situations and circumstances that may have arisen around that. And you already started talking about early in your tenure there with Mr. Crockett Sr. in that story. But I wondered, Les, if you could really basically start at the beginning of your run in Charlotte. What territory did you arrive from? Who brought you in? Just the whole thing around that and why you made the decision to go to Charlotte.
Excuse me. The first big territory, I broke in Boston, for those who don't know, and with Tony Santos. It was a small promotion, in the New England area. And then I wanted to, there were obviously 25 to 30 territories at that point in time. This was in the 60s. And so my next territory was the Indianapolis Barnett Doyle office. My home is Cincinnati, so I'd come home in 61, and I got my first shot with them in 62. From there, we went to Calgary with some guys, spent part of the summer in Calgary, came back back home and continued to work for the Barnett Doyle office. And then in early 63, looking for something fresh, because at that time I was learning my craft, so I was doing jobs. It wasn't like I was being the big star any place, or good, which was fine. That was the way the business was, was operated at that point in time. And so I had heard so much about the Carolina territory, I just, I thought I'd like to give that a try. You couldn't just call the office and say, hey, I'm a wrestler, I want to come in and work for you. If they didn't know you, if you didn't have a track record or a reputation, then you needed references. So my references were the Scott brothers, George and Sandy, Jim Grabmeier, who was an Ohio boy himself, and I had traveled with around that territory and got to know, and Johnny Heidemann, who had a home in Charlotte. I was a New Yorker by birth, but had been around the business for a long time, and I had worked with him in the Indianapolis territory as well. So those were my references to come to the Charlotte territory for the very first time in 1963. And Charlotte at that time was just a huge country town, really. Now it's obviously growing into a metropolis with a lot of big business. And, well, back then there was no Carolina Panthers. There was no basketball NBA team. There was, at the time, actually, there wasn't even a minor league baseball team, I don't believe. So wrestling was so huge in that area. And that was, it was a great learning time for me in 63. Again, I was looking at the lights 99% of the time, which, again, was fine because I got the chance to work with a lot of, very good veteran wrestlers, and it was just like going to school.
Who were some of the guys you had a chance to get into the ring with?
Aldo Bogni and Bronco Lubitsch was a great heel tag team at the time. Lubitsch, some may, probably the younger people remember, as a referee in the Dallas territory. But Bronco had managed Angelo Poffo, Randy Savage's dad, in several places, but he was also a damn solid heel to work with. And one of the things that we all had a sense of humor, and there were times in the ring that we could play a little bit, but the fans didn't know that we were doing that. And I remember a lot of times, sometimes to walk out to get the referee's instructions in those tag matches, Bronco would say, hey, kid, hit me hard when we first start the match. That way I'll be numb through the rest of the thing when you're being stiff with me, that sort of thing. Just being joking and everything. But the Assassins, Jody Hamilton and Tom Ernesto, who drew big money in every territory they went to, I had the opportunity to work with them there. The Hines brothers, who were old carnival wrestlers, Billy and Jimmy Hines. And, a lot of Missouri Mahler. I'm trying to think who, I think it was Furpo. Pompero Furpo was Larry's, Larry Hamilton, Jody Hamilton's, who's the Assassin's brother, was the Missouri Mahler. So a lot of, a lot of good experienced heel teams. And again, it was just a matter of going in and listening, and these guys are such great manipulators as the match went on that they could build a match from scratch, because back then all we knew was the finish. You know, no matter how long we were going to go, it wasn't laid out for us, anybody in the dressing room. You know, they might say, hey, remember we did this spot in Roanoke, Virginia a couple weeks ago? Well, if it fits, we'll throw it in here. So it was, I stayed there, I think about 6 months the first time. And, so, you know, it was a great learning experience for me. And of course, a nice little town, and had a lot of fun. Had a lot of fun there, too. The next time I went back was, I won't go through the whole litany, you know, the whole registration of all the territories I worked before I went back. But after getting the Rookie of the Year Award and NWA Rookie of the Year Award in Tampa, presented to me there. Roger Kirby, Dennis Hall, and I wrestled as cousins and covered quite a few territories in the Southeast. But at the time, Dennis had been in another territory. Kirby and I were working as partners in Tampa, and we decided to go back to the Carolinas, and that was in 1967. And so when we went in, George Becker was the booker, he decided he wanted to keep Hall and Kirby together as a team, and they started. I worked with several different partners there at that time. My next door neighbor, who I went to his he later had a territory in the Maritime Provinces, Rudy Kay, was my partner some. Who else at that time? Manuel Zuma, the Amazing Zuma. Gosh, I worked with several different guys. But finally, what was a big break for me then at that point in time was there were a lot of teams with, I think there was about five teams with managers during that period. Well, you know, for those who don't know, the Carolinas, before George Scott got the book after the passing of Jim Crockett Sr., was predominantly a tag team territory. Usually two tag teams on every show, and mostly the main event would be tag matches, except unless, you know, when the NWA World Champion or the Mid-Atlantic Singles Champion was involved, and you know, then they would be high on the card as well. But so Becker and Weaver, George was the booker, and so obviously they were the number one tag team in the territory. So they, you know, obviously would work with these teams with a heel manager, and a manager would get involved, and so it would escalate to a six-man tag. So looking for a fresh partner, and it all started in Spartanburg, North Carolina. The gentleman who spoke up for me there was a nice guy by the name of Wally Dusick. You've heard of the Dusick clan, the Riot Squad Dusicks. And Wally was an ex-wrestler who was actually at that time worked for the Crockett office, and he would help with the box office in different shows and carry the ring. So they were talking in the office, as I understand it, because I wasn't there, and Becker and Weaver needed another baby face. They wanted to use somebody fresh in Spartanburg to start working, you know, to build the six-mans with a heel team and their manager against Becker, Weaver, and another baby face. And Wally Dusick said, he suggested me. He said, you know, the kid works hard, he's no problem, and he's gotten over in Spartanburg, because for some reason, you know, I had gotten a lot of shots there. So anyway, that's how it all started with me and Becker and Weaver. And then that built to the big Charlotte Coliseum show Christmas show in 1967, and we've talked about that on the show here, so I'm not going to run it into the ground, but basically they ran the Charlotte Coliseum on special occasions, and we set up a deal where they were working with the Infernos, which was another great heel team of the time, Rocky Smith and Frankie Kane as the Infernos, with a manager, Jimmy Dykes. And so they were working a deal in September at the Charlotte Coliseum. The referee was knocked loopy in the first round, in the first fall, because most main events at that point in time were 2 out of 3 falls. In fact, a lot of the matches were 2 out of 3 falls. But anyway, so I was called upon to referee, which led to the baby faces getting over, the heels snatching me after the babyface had left the ring, J.C. Dykes throwing fire in my face, and me going down, you know, with the burn. And so the angle built to the big Christmas show, Christmas Day of 1967, and at that point in time, we set the record for attendance at a Mid-Atlantic wrestling show on Christmas. It was Becker Weaver and myself against Dykes and the Infernos. So I was used really well. I spent about a year and a half in there at that point in time, and then figured it was time, you know, to get out, needed a break, you know. But I, you know, after that, I got to work, you know, quite a few shots with them as six-mans. And so, but I left the territory in late 68, in the fall of 68, and spent about a year and a half there that time, and went to Tennessee from there and on and on and on, and didn't go back again until 1971. I had, I mentioned Rudy Kay, and I'd been to the Nashville territory and went to the Nashville territory, and early 70 went to the Maritimes to work for my, like I say, my former next door neighbor and a guy had been my partner. That's where I first got my broadcasting experience, was also in the Maritimes. And out of the Maritimes, came back into Nashville for a short period of time, went to Tampa because Leo Garibaldi was the booker there at the time and one of my mentors in terms of teaching me psychology and that sort of thing. So anyway, was doing okay, you know, was doing okay in Tampa in 71. And well, another one of the assistant bookers, Louis Tillette, called me one day and said, Charlotte's looking for a number two babyface team behind Becker and Weaver, some guys fresh. And I suggested you and Danny Miller. We hit it off great as a team. We worked some six-mans and a couple team matches around the Tampa territory. But I guess just because we were both Ohio boys, you know. Danny and his brother had both graduated from Ohio State, played football there, wrestled there. Bill, the older brother, Dr. Big Bill Miller, Dr. X, whatever you want, you know, was a big star. And Bill had actually played, I think it was the 1950 Rose Bowl team at Ohio State, and had gone on to, you know, to do well in professional wrestling. So anyway, Danny and I came back in 1971 back into the Charlotte territory. And then I escalated into working in the doing stuff in the office.
You know what, before you get into the office stuff, now this most recent trip in 71, can you just talk about a little bit about the uniqueness, if that's even a word, of the fact that Charlotte up until that time was a tag team based territory and how different that was from every other territory in the area? Plus, from there, you know, there's quite a bit of change in the territory during your tenure here from 71 forward, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it still was a major tag team territory. One of the big matches I think it was April, I'm not sure, late April, early May, maybe May, yeah, when we came to Charlotte, when Danny and I came to Charlotte, and, excuse me, it was still a big tag team territory at that time. In fact, one of the first big shows we did was 4th of July, and we had worked, Billy Garrett and Jim Starr, managed by Ken Ramey, and I'm not sure if they were the interns, the medics, the masked hooty-hoos or what, I forget what name exactly, because they had worked under several different names, the team had worked under several different names, but the big setup for that 4th of July show was Danny and I against them, mask against hair. We were the semifinal, and Johnny Weaver against Dory Jr. for the NWA World title was the big main event. And Danny and I unmasked, Jim and Willie. So anyway, you know, that was, it was still, like I say, it's still a big tag team territory. And it actually didn't change until Mr. Crockett's passing. Jimmy Jr. and took over the driver's seat, and George Becker was moved out as booker, and George Scott was moved in. That would have been, I think, 73, late 72, early 73. I do not remember. Anyway, it was after Mr. Crockett Sr., Jim Sr.'s passing. And so, you know, that was the, and we'll get into that. How I got started in in the with the office at all was I was fascinated, and let me back up a little bit. When I first went to Atlanta in 1966, one of the things that fascinated me was the way Leo Garibaldi was getting his people over in his weekly program, printed program that they sold at the matches before they ever came in the territory. Again, you've got to realize at this point, I'm still like 6 years into the business, and part of, you know, there are certain parts of the business that I hadn't been exposed to, and I had the opportunity to watch Leo build these programs. But at the time, he was getting ready to bring Tim Woods in as Mr. Wrestling, which obviously grew into a phenomenal thing for Tim as well as for the Atlanta territory. He was, you know, putting Tim, pictures of Tim with the mask and his little stories. Before Tim ever stepped foot into the state of Georgia, they had him over to some degree, you know, with the program. And it just kind of fascinated me. It's just something I guess I put in the back of my mind to, you know, filed it there for a later date. So anyway, just looking at some old photo albums that had been sold in the Mid-Atlantic territory through Crockett Promotions. And I just happened to be talking to Mr. Crockett one day, and I was looking at these, and I said, you don't do these anymore. Why not? He said, well, somebody in the office had done them, and they just had either moved on or something. And I said, wow. I said, you know, I don't even know what the conversation, I don't remember that conversation that well, but at some point Mr. Crockett said, well, why don't you give it a try? I said, why? He said, why don't you put one together? Really? Yeah. I thought, you know, okay, I'll give it a try. So I started by putting together a couple photo albums for the office and, you know, design a cover a little differently. I remember took all the Mid-Atlantic Championship belts to make the W in the word wrestling, right, on the front of one of these albums, and getting a photographer to climb a step ladder so he can shoot down and get this done properly. Anyway, so that escalated into me doing then a printed program type of thing, because nobody was doing, you know, a weekly program. And this was sold actually, it was a black and white and sold in several of the towns. It wasn't sold all over the territory. But anyway, and that escalated into me being the editor and designer and major creative force behind the Mid-Atlantic Wrestling Magazine, which was the first full color magazine, first wrestling magazine on glossy paper, opposed to the cheaper stuff. The first wrestling magazine with a centerfold, with a theme centerfold. The only wrestling magazine, as far as I'm aware, with an art, a themed cover done by an artist. In other words, we didn't use necessarily, we graduated from photographs to artwork, you know, themed covers. And those magazines today, if you can find them, sell, I guess, for $50 a piece and up. So that was how I got involved in the office, and then that, I was in the office also talking to Mr. Crockett Sr., and Lord Littlebrook was in the territory, who had been in the Maritime Provinces in 1970 when I was up there. And Littlebrook said to Mr. Crockett one day, why is it Les, I can't do the English accent, Les, why is it Les on your TV, Mr. Crockett? And Jim looked at Brooke and said, well, he is on my TV. No, he said, I don't mean wrestling. I mean as a commentator. And Jim said, what are you talking about? And Brooke said, well, you know, he did Rudy's TV up in the Maritimes when I was up there and did a hell of a job. And Mr. Crockett looked at me and said, well, you never say anything to me. And I said, well, you never ask. I mean, I know that's, you know, you hear that line, but that's, you know, that's the way the conversation started. So he said, well, maybe we can work you into something. And realizing back then that, I won't say that the guys who did the TVs weren't smart to the business, but they weren't smartened up by the office or the wrestlers or the booker, right? If they got smart, they figured it out on their own. But one of the things that first started was Big Bill Ward, who did the Charlotte TV, on what we taped there on Wednesday nights at Channel 3. spent a lot, and it was kind of cool too, but he spent a lot, you know, I want to wish a happy birthday to Miss Fannie Mae, who's this her 91st birthday, and because Bill was a celebrity, on Channel 3 other than, you know, dealing with, wrestling. So, I mean, you know, he had his own show and did news, I think, and weather, and anyway. But a lot of times, since he wasn't privy to an angle that was being shot on the TV or to a run-in or something, he was in the midst of wishing Miss Fannie Mae a happy birthday on her 91st birthday when he should have been talking, you know, getting excited about what was happening in the ring. So I was that guy on several of the TVs to start with. There used to be a TV in High Point, North Carolina, besides the, obviously where Raleigh was part of the taping for years and years. But then the Charlotte TV was done as well. So I slid around, you know, I was privy to the angles, to the storylines, and so part of my job was to override the announcers who weren't doing, you know, bringing the viewers' eyes to where they should be in terms of watching what was going on in the ring. And then, of course,
you were in great position to steer the conversation when and where it needed to be steered, and also perhaps, since you were aware of the angles, provide a little foreshadowing.
Yeah. And get more into, you know, personalities of the wrestlers, because I was a wrestler myself. And, so all between the then I start handling all the promos that we did, in Raleigh. And for those, that was, now it was a Neanderthal thing back in the 70s, I suppose, but, we did over 125, promos. Interviews, whatever the hell you want to call them, in Raleigh on starting at noon on Wednesday and going till sometimes 5:30. It was, you know, it wasn't the high-tech thing of, but it was, you know, each pro, there were like 2 2-minute 20-second spots that were fit into each show that was taped and sent out. And there were two shows, the same Raleigh show was, it was a dual recording. Bob Cottle was hosting one show, I was hosting the other, and when I wasn't hosting the other, Ed Capel was. But they was the same show, but one was called, you know, Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling, the other was, Worldwide Wrestling, or Wide World of Wrestling, whichever. But anyway, and plus some of the promos were sent out 30-second spots, but, you know, you'd stay on the set and, for the first 2 minutes 20, one guy'd come in from the right, and we had a back timer that a photographer uses under the camera lens, and that's how we timed these things out. But it was a marathon taping every Wednesday. So anyway, I was involved in the television production. I was involved in promotion, publicity, public relations. I spent the time to build a promotional package, which if you were doing a spot show, you know, say you were the VFW in some town in North or South Carolina doing a spot show, then I had built a package that they could send out to you, which had, ad slicks, the borders, which you have filled the names in, samples of how to write an ad for wrestling in your newspaper, blah, 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 that sort of thing. But anyway, so then I ended up with Mr. Crockett had passed away. The old office was at 1111 East Moorhead Street, which was a big old white two-story house in a really tree-lined area. It was really a pretty, pretty area. And then once Mr. Crockett passed away later on, Jimmy and the rest of the family moved the office to Briar Bend Drive into an office complex. And at that point, I was given an office like everybody else in the building. And George Scott and I'd sit down on Mondays and go through every friggin' show where the TV went to write, figure who was going to do the promos and this and that and the other thing. So anyway, that was, you know, how I got involved. But I left, as we talked about last week, in 73, I went to Atlanta to work with Gordon Solie and work in the office there, and went back, and Bobby Shane and I worked an angle. Off the TV in Macon, would have gone on and been on the TV in Atlanta, but then, Barnett bought in. I went back to Charlotte. Leo was relieved as the booker and went on. I think he went to Tampa again and then to Texas. But anyway, and then I came back to Charlotte in 74 and resumed my position, you know, with the office and the magazine. And, well, I was still doing their weekly program while I was in Atlanta and just mailing it up there to be printed. And, but then the big magazine I mentioned earlier with the awful color, the artistic covers and the centerfold and everything started when I came back in 74.
You're doing the programs, you're doing the commentary, you're also the guy who's handling the interviews on a weekly basis.
And wrestling.
I was going to say, and you're wrestling a full-time schedule at this point.
Yes. And, well, wow. Yeah, I'm not, well, I wasn't wrestling 5 nights a week, but at least 3. And also, from November 74 till November of 77, I was flying to Knoxville on Fridays, wrestling in Knoxville on Friday, producing their television, hosting their television on, and doing that on Saturday, wrestling on a, one of their shows Saturday night, getting back on the plane Sunday, going back to Charlotte. So
that's impossible.
I pass myself in the air once in a while. Hi, Les, there you go. Here I am. You know, that sort of thing. So anyway, yeah, so that was, you know, and, but I left Charlotte in 77 and actually there was one other time that I would have ended up, but then Jimmy sold the business to Vince. I had moved, I left Knoxville in 1985. My dad passed away in 83. I came home from Knoxville, came in off the road after all those years, starting in the business in 60. I lived on the road through till 85 and came home to kind of help my mother. And of course got involved with the Smoky Mountain TV, and so forth. But anyway, I can't give you a timeline because I don't remember, but I remember Jim Crockett Jr. calling me. And this was when they were, you know, had gone national. And, said that he had plans to start a third production unit. And if I recall correctly, the rough plans were to base it out of Nashville or something. But anyway, he had contacted me with the idea that, he would offer me the position of, being one of the broadcasters on that third production team and more or less overseeing the entire operation. And of course I was interested, but then, you know, their business started to drop off and Vince's started to pick up. And so it never, you know, it never got wings. It never flew. But, my involvement with the family, with, the company was always, I enjoyed it. I had, you know, Jackie Crockett, who was the youngest of the brothers, one sister, Frances, and then, Jimmy, David and Jackie, and Jackie was young. He and I socialized quite a bit, worked with all the Francis was a big help with me with the magazines and the public relations, and I enjoyed my time there. And Mr. Crockett, Jim Sr., was a class guy, and, you know, I respect and admire him very, very much. Actually, I'm looking forward to Charlotte. I don't know, Jackie's always there. Francis was there a couple years ago, and for some reason, I just never got a chance to say hello. But she's now one of my friends on Facebook. So anyway, my time, my relationship. Well, and the other thing I guess I should throw in here, my wife, Alice, who we just mentioned earlier, the first time I ever met her was in 1967 in Charlotte. We didn't get married. We didn't even date then. But that was the first time that we were introduced, was in 1967 in Charlotte.
So for many reasons, most of which have been enumerated here, Charlotte holds a special place in your heart. And I dare say, Les, that you could have at least been like cousin Les Crockett for all the work you did in the office.
Well, I didn't inherit anything, and I don't use the name. But, yeah, you know, it was, like I say, you know, the one thing I want to mention about the magazines, we also did the first, last, and only, from that point forward, as far as I know, an NWA magazine in 1975 when Terry, the cover was Terry Funk with the belt, and he was a centerfold, and we did a page for each NWA territory. And I'll never forget, I was sitting in my little cubicle, And Jimmy had been at an NWA meeting somewhere and came in and said, I picked up a little project for us. Well, I said, the NWA meeting. I said, yeah, what was that? We're going to do a magazine for the entire alliance. Oh, a little project. Okay. So anyway, that, you know, if that magazine, if you've got that, if you have a copy of that magazine, it was the one and only. So I don't know what the hell that's, that might be worth at this point in time. But I'll tell you the truth, the crazy thing, Jackie, I said this to Jackie Crockett, the first Charlotte Fan Fest I went to in 2004, I saw one of the Mid-Atlantic magazines on one of the memorabilia tables with a price of $50 on it. And then Dick Bourne, who did the Big Gold Belt, is the name of the book that Dick,
yes,
and has Mid-Atlantic Gateway website, told me that he had paid like $125 for one of those magazines. And I said to Jackie Crockett, who was at that same convention, damn, don't you wish we had a few cases of magazines to sell? Because I can remember, they had a cook come in a lot of times to fix lunch at the Charlotte office when we were on Briarbend, and the big warehouse was connected next door, where we kept a lot of stuff, you know. And I remember Jim Jr. saying to Jackie and I, listen, if you guys aren't going to do it, don't have anything really pressing after lunch, why don't you go through some of the back issues of magazines and toss them? I thought, wow.
Oh.
At $50 a pop, how much money did we throw into a dumpster someplace, right?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh.
I thought, why didn't I have the presence of mind to put those boxes of magazines in my car and take them home? But anyway, that was, it's been a big part of my life, the territory, and I have a lot of great memories there. I really do. It's always enjoyable to go back. And of course, now, the original Coliseum is now the Bojangles Coliseum and is utilized for they have a bigger place, but a lot of great memories for me there. And the cool thing about the Fan Fest too is some of the fans that came to the matches, you know, back then are still in attendance at these Fan Fests. So it's like, it's like old home week. It's like a family reunion more than anything else.
Hey, we're short on time, but I suspect we're going to end up going a few minutes over. Since we're paying you the big bucks, I'm sure you won't mind putting an extra hour on your timesheet this week.
Oh, no.
But I do feel like I would be a little bit remiss if I didn't ask you to rewind just a little bit back to that second trip in where all the extracurricular activities with the magazine and the office and the promos began, because that's also...
That was the third trip in.
Oh, the third trip in, excuse me. I'm looking to get back to the time when the territory changed hands from Mr. Crockett Sr. to Mr. Crockett Jr. and the arrival of George Scott as Booker. And I'm just wondering what it was like to be in the locker room as the winds of change literally are sweeping through, and kind of the reactions of some of the boys and how you were able to get along, or your working experiences with George once you became a part of the office.
My working with George was fine because we had, been friends. We first met in the Indianapolis territory in 1962. And so we were at that point in time, I guess it had a 10-year relationship. I always got along with the Scots, both of them. And the reason that Vincent Kennedy McMahon offered me a job in 1985 or 84, whatever it was, when he was starting to mount his deal, was when George Scott was the booker up there, and George was one of the people that wanted me on board. I had done Vince's magazine, which was in terms of format and layout, was a carbon copy of the Mid-Atlantic magazine. For the WWWF, I did four issues for Vince himself, so I had a working relationship with him as well. But they had offered me a spot on the WWF office in 1985. Part of the reason for getting that offer was George Scott, because he wanted me on board to work with him and help him with the promos and the interviews and stuff. And so it was, I remember standing in the parking lot outside of Channel 3 with John Ringley, who's Francis, formerly was married to Francis Crockett, and part of the infrastructure of the business. He was worked in the office there, not only with wrestling, but with the Globetrotters and all the other things that the Crockett's Jim Crockett Promotions promoted at that point in time. And I remember him saying that George was taking over as the booker, and in essence, he was going to kill the territory, and he did. I mean, when I say that, by switching over to the singles and featuring the individuals more than teams, and the top heel that he brought in to build at that time was Johnny Valentine, Greg Valentine's father. And John was a methodical worker. I mean, John didn't get warmed up till 20 minutes in. So you weren't going to see the same. I mean, there were still tag matches on the shows, but I remember when they first started getting him over as a heel there, how some of the people, the regulars, would get up and leave in the middle of the match because it, you know, but then a year later, those same people weren't going anywhere because it took time to build and establish singles, stars. And of course, then later on, Wahoo came in and, you know, the whole thing, escalated and built to a lot of great singles and still as well as the tags because later on, as you recall, that was the home of the Four Horsemen. That was where they originated. The Rock and Roll Express was a big, big team for them. So, I mean, it was a combination of both, but the transition, it did bring the territory down for a while, you know.
Did you have any hang-ups or doubts or concerns that it wouldn't catch on?
You know, the crazy thing is, as much as I may sit and pick things apart today, because of bad comedy or bad book, you know, I had faith in the bookers. Honest, you know, the ones I worked with. And that was the nice thing about having territories where if you were in a territory, we didn't have faith in the booker or, you could pick up the phone and call someone and go somewhere else. You can't do that today. I was always utilized well there, regardless of what my particular role was. And sometimes, you know, my role in 63 was getting guys over. My role in 66 or 67 was to be the third, you know, the third guy on the Becker Weaver team, and of course they used me well as a single too to keep me good, you know, to work with those guys. And then Danny and I went in as the number two babyface team in 71, and then once I was established in the office with the television and the magazines and public relations, then obviously I worked mid card for the most part at that point in time, you know, because but I made a good living. That was it. But, you know, my relationship there was just amazing. I enjoyed the hell out of it, to be honest.
Last story before we wrap this up, because I know Doc Young will be looking at his watch and stomping his foot impatiently. I can't let this hour get away or hour plus get away without pointing out, especially for those who are listening to us for the first time and may never have heard this story before, Les, the fact that you worked one of the very first matches in the territory for a pre-Nature Boy, Ric Flair.
I did. A 280-pound Ric Flair, as a matter of fact. Yeah, I never forget it. At first, I thought it was the first match I had with him, but obviously it was his first match in that territory, and obviously I found out later that it wasn't. Our friend Dave Meltzer spends more time recording, you know, digging into historical things than I do. But anyway, Richmond, Virginia, the old fairgrounds building where we used to wrestle every Friday night in Richmond. Obviously in different dressing rooms. I'd never laid eyes on this guy before in my life. And Joe Murnick, who was the Joe and Elliot and Carl Murnick, his sons, were the promoters of Richmond, Norfolk, Raleigh, and several other towns. But anyway, Joe came in and said, you're working with the new kid from Minneapolis, one of Vern's. And I thought, oh, Jesus, another shooter. He'll be stiff as a board. Right. I hope I can loosen him up. So I didn't know what the kid looked like, right? And what do you want to do for a finish? And I said, this or that, whatever it was. And you guys, you need to go. I don't know. We went 12 minutes or 10, 15, whatever it was. You know, we were in one of the preliminary matches. And so my first look at Ric Flair, my first introduction to Ric Flair, was in the middle of that Richmond ring. And whoever the referee, whether it was Sonny Fargo or Lucky Roberts or Angelo Martinelli or whoever, you know, called us to the middle of the ring, and he said, "How are you?" And I said, "I'm fine. Yourself? Good. You're going to lead the match?" "Yes, I sir." "And yes, I am." And we had, you know, I didn't know what to expect, and he didn't either, for that matter, right? But I thought, and at the time, he had just been in the business about a year, give or take a few weeks or a month, whatever. And so I was amazed with the talent the kid had for just a year. And so when I'll never forget, because I went back to the babyface dressing room, I said, "This kid's going to have a future in this business." And boy, talk about Les Thatcher's gross understatement of his career. That must have been it. I guess this kid's going to have a future, I guess. He was the future in many ways to our business. So that was my first encounter with Ric Flair. And like I say, he was 280 pounds at the time.
How quickly did he improve upon those skills you saw for the first time at that point? Was his learning curve really quick?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He came. Well, you know, he was a natural. But you know what? We started this show today. We were talking about Roman Reigns needing to work with guys who could. One of the first things that George Scott did was started sitting him down in front of a lot of Nature Boy Buddy Rogers' videos that he could get his hands on, and made Flair watch Rogers over and over and over and over again. Rogers came in later, and of course, you know, was a mentor to Rick as well. But we're talking about tag teams. One of the things he did is too was that they had Hawk and Hansen. I forgot to mention them through the 71 and 67. I mean, 67. My God, Hawk and Hansen were the mainstay teams of that territory for years and years and years. And they were managed by Gary Hart for a part of that time. Anyway, Sweet had been switched babyface. Sweet had a nightclub in Charlotte in the 70s. So obviously it was to his benefit business wise to be a babyface. So Rip Hawk did not have a steady partner at the time. So Flair was, George Scott put Flair with Hawk so Hawk could mentor him and teach him more, you know. Tag team psychology is quite a bit different from singles psychology anyway. So anyway, you know, he was still learning. George would say to me, you know, if he had to walk, went without saying once we talked about it, we're doing the Wednesday interviews. If Flair gets off on the wrong track, shut him down and tell him what you want and put him back where you know, and cut it again. We didn't have to do that a lot. He was just, you know, he caught on quick and was a natural. But, of course, he had a lot of good baby faces to work with and a heel partner who understood the business inside and out.
I got about 16 other questions, but they'll have to wait.
I'm sure they will. I'm sure they will.
Let me just point out one more time to those who are listening to us for free today that this is just one of many shows, 12 to 15 new radio shows each and every week, Doc Young's Wrestling Weekly, one of many, and they're all really, really good, and you also get a couple of times a week Wrestling Observer Radio with Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez if you choose to subscribe at WrestlingObserver.com and or F4WOnline.com. Either one of those addresses will get you to the site where you can sign up for just $9.99 a month. Not only do you get those 12 to 15 new radio shows each and every week, you also get the Figure Four weekly newsletter from Brian Alvarez, the preeminent wrestling journalist of our time, Dave Meltzer's Wrestling Observer newsletter, and you also get the archives, which are really, really cool. Not only do you get a chance to go back through old Observers and old Figure Four weeklies, you also have over 6,000 archived audio shows in the podcast section archive, dating all the way back to 2005. So there is so much material for you to go through for your $9.99 a month. And, of course, we like to think that Doc Young's Wrestling Weekly is an important part of that. And not only do you get a chance to listen to shows like this, but we've had the opportunity to talk a little bit more about Charlotte recently, or not so recently, actually, in the archives, with folks like Mike Mooneyham, Jerry Briscoe. We've had Lance Storm on the show a couple of times.
J. Dillon.
Nearly 2 hours with James J. Dillon. So there's lots of great stuff you can go through in the archives of just Doc Young's Wrestling Weekly alone. Never mind, you know, the 12 to 15 shows, all of which have archives here at WrestlingObserver.com. Now, Les, You're getting ready to go spend the weekend in Charlotte and have a great time there.
I'm headed to Charlotte next Wednesday, and then Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the 31st through August the 3rd, is the big Legends Fan Fest, and it's the last one, the 10th anniversary. My primary objective, I guess, is myself, Dr. Tom Pritchard, Lance Storm, Nigel McGuinness, and Jerry Briscoe. We're running a four-day training camp at the convention Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And the best camper, as designated by the trainers, will receive a $2,500 Reed Flair Memorial Scholarship Fund to help them further their career, buy new boots, go to other camps, whatever the case may be, anything wrestling-related, up to $2,500 will be covered for that particular guy. Of course, this is a great convention. There's going to be Q&A sessions, photo sessions, autograph sessions, all the merchandise set up, the big Hall of Heroes banquet on Friday night, which is sold out. I guess you can get on the waiting list. Thursday is open. I mean, the convention in terms of the merchandise, the vendors, and to walk around and introduce your... A lot of the vendors will have wrestlers that, you know, in their booths and stuff, too. That's actually open to the public for free on Thursday. And but you can get one-day VIP. Jimmy Cornette, of course, is going to have a Q&A session. Dusty Rhodes, which will include Kevin Sullivan, J.J. Dillon, Magnum. We'll all be involved in the Q&A session there. You can, the VIPs, you can get your picture taken with Harley Race and Dusty Rhodes. Harley was the first, Dusty won his first title, NWA World title from Harley. All that's going on, in Charlotte next weekend. I'm excited to get over there and have a good time and work with the kids. And I'll also be doing play-by-play on the show Saturday night and Sunday afternoon. And I think I help clean up and sweep too. But whatever. Yeah, it's going to be a great time. You can go to, NWA or Mid-Atlantic Legends, .com and get all the information. Like I say, the banquet is sold out, but there's still plenty of room, to go to the other functions. And, if you haven't been, you owe it to yourself to go. A lot of rest. I don't know how many guys are going to be in attendance, but there's going to be a bunch of, plus on the wrestling shows, the Greek God Papadon, Luke Hawk, the American Wolves, among others will be on wrestling on the shows as well. So, you know, that's a great thing too. And then I've got some dates open in August. Anybody's interested? you can reach me, Les at epwt.com. You can check out, I'm about to run down some of my appearances, and, the contact info is or will be on the front page of epwt.com, which is for Elite Pro Wrestling Training. So anyway, September, as I mentioned to you, Vic, I'm Labor Day weekend, I'm off taking a deep breath, and then I am off legitimately to the races every weekend throughout the rest of the month. Saturday and Sunday, September 13th and 14th, on Sunday or Saturday the 13th, I'm in Blue Ridge, Georgia. It's my third camp that I'm doing there. This one we're only doing for one day. That's Deep Southern Championship Wrestling, a full day of training and an evening show if you're coming to. And Woody says he's setting up two rings. We have such a turnout from North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, and Alabama, I think, are the five states that are. And he's got a couple girls signed up as well. He's putting up two rings. We've got that kind of turnout. Anyway, if you're interested, we're doing a full day of training starting at 9 a.m. on that Saturday, and you'll be included in the show. I guess he's probably going to run a two-ring battle royal. We did last year as well. Anyway, to sign up, you can go to www.dscw.org, or you can call Woody 706-633-4396. The next morning, on Sunday the 14th, I'm driving up to Knoxville, which is one of my old haunts, along with Charlotte, to be involved in the Southeastern Championship Wrestling Reunion at the Tennessee Valley Fair at Chilhowee Park, which is where we used to wrestle. And that starts at 4 p.m. There will be three matches. I don't know who are in the matches. I doubt seriously if any of us old beat-up guys are. But anyway, three matches on this thing. And then I'm hosting a Q&A roundtable with the legends, Paul Orndorff, Bob Armstrong, Bob Orton Jr., Ronnie Garvin, Robert Fuller, Jimmy Golden, the Mongolian Stomper, Ron and Don Wright, Tony Peters. And if you want more information on that, you can call 865-973-8092 for more info. And then Saturday and Sunday, September 20th, 21st, I don't have all the details, but for my buddy Antonio Thomas, I'll be in Palmer, Mass., actually just outside of Springfield, for a weekend camp there. It'll be my second time up there. The big deal for me is on that Friday when I get in, we're going to the Basketball Hall of Fame.
Hey.
Check that out. But anyway, you can call Antonio. I'll have more details, and that'll be up on my website as quick as I can get them up. You can call Antonio at 413-244-4983 for more details and pricing on that. And then the following weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, September 26, 27, 28, damn, I'm going to wear myself out just talking about this stuff. I'm going to be in Paulsboro, New Jersey, along with my friend Vic Socia.
All right, I will see you there.
At the Monster Factory for Danny Cage. And hope you know, my first time there, I saw a picture of their facility. They've got a great setup. And anyway, if you're interested in signing up or joining us, in Paulsboro for the weekend camp, this Friday night Q&A, training all day Saturday and Sunday. You can call Danny at 609-471-7904, or you can email monsterfactoryseminar@gmail.com and check that out. So, wow, I'm wore out. I don't know if I'll make those trips or not.
Les is also available for birthday parties, bar mitzvahs, and he will play Santa.
Yes, and I haunt houses too, if that's necessary. Anyway, so that's it for, but like I say, you can contact me, les@epwt.com, if you're interested in booking me for a, I prefer to do weekend camps, honestly, rather than single day, but either way, I am available.
So Les is going to get his oxygen tank and take it to Charlotte with him.
Yeah.
Make sure that he's got enough air to make it through this next weekend.
Right. You and I, you're going to be visiting with your grandmother, and I think that's, I mean, honest to God, when I say this, I'm not being funny. I think that's great.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I'm taking a side trip to Fort Myers, Florida to go visit some family, grandma included. So
we won't be doing
we'll
a
find
show
a way
next
to
week.
Rendezvous. Right. We will find a way to rendezvous week after next.
Absolutely. And if you have any questions for us, please drop Vic an email. You know, honestly, I prefer covering the historical stuff. I know everybody else on the site pounds away at current stuff, and which is fine, and I don't mind touching on that too. You know, but you know, it's fun to go back and check the memories out. What few brain cells I have left from the 60s and 70s and the 80s as well.
If you're already a member of the site, you can definitely drop me a line by venturing over to the board. I know that's torturous for some of you, but you can always send me a direct message on the board. I'm happy to take your questions there. And you can also send me, in fact, you know what? I should get an email dedicated to this. But in the meantime, you can send it to Winter, but spell it like this, WYNTER 900, that's 900, at AOL.com, and quit judging me for still having an AOL. Just send the damn question.
And you can also go on the board and rip me. I don't go on the board, but
you say whatever you want about Les on the board, he won't see it.
Okay. I have a friend that loves to see how high I can get my blood pressure, so he'll cut and paste me some of the derogatory remarks, and I think that's just fine as long as I stimulate some feeling in you. Whatever that feeling may be, I guess I'm doing my job.
So we thank you so much for spending some quality time with us here this week at Doc Young's Wrestling Weekly. He is the legend, Les Thatcher. My name is Victor Sosa. We will be back in 2 weeks' time.